From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forums next hour, Jane Hirschfield's poetry has been described as generous, insightful, and sensuously philosophical. The Bay Area-based poet recently published two books, a book of poetry called The Beauty and a collection of essays titled 10 Windows, How Great Poems Transform the World. She'll join us in studio to talk about her latest work and her continuing discoveries about the power of poetry. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. In this hour, we welcome Bay Area-based award-winning poet Jane Hirschfield to the second hour, and she has recently published her eighth collection of poems called The Beauty, as well as her second collection of essays, 10 Windows, How Great Poems Transform the World. Jane Hirschfield is a recipient of the California Book Award, the Poetry Center Award, and the Donald Hall Jane Kenyon Prize in American Poetry, and her poems have appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Poetry, and The New Republic. And she is the current chancellor of the American Academy of Poets and joins us here in studio. Welcome. Welcome back.
Pleasure to be here.
What do chancellors do in the American Academy of Poets?
We advise and represent poetry. So it's an honorary position. And mostly we help steer one of the oldest organizations in American poetry. National Poetry Month, which it is now, was a program developed by the Academy of American Poets. They initiated National Poetry Month. So we make suggestions and then we obligingly go about and speak for poetry.
Well, there are people right here like you and Kay Ryan and Bob Haas who speak mellifluously and wonderfully about poetry. And the thing I realized in reading your new collection of poems is just how much wisdom you communicate in your poetry. I mean, that may come from your, at least partially to a degree, from your Zen background, but it also comes from your observational powers, which are, may I say, exceptional. And there's a line that comes to me right away from your poetry. Now I am 60, there was no other life. And I was thinking, you know, many would see that as kind of a blockade or something, you know, I can't continue to invent myself. But the past and the way you're shaped, I use the word ontological advisedly, it's already there by 60.
Yes. Well, should I read the poem?
Why don't you?
Okay. The title, which might not make sense, that's all right. It was once a longer poem with a kitchen towel in it. The title is A Cottony Fate. Long ago, someone told me, avoid ore. It troubles the mind, as a held-out piece of meat disturbs a dog. Now I too am 60. There was no other life. Now, that initial advice about avoiding ore I got when I was 18 from a teacher when I was an undergraduate, and it was a piece of poetic craft advice to watch out for using ore in poems. And it was only these decades later that it suddenly occurred to me it is an interesting question to bring to your relationship to your own life. And what I've found is by the time one is 60, which my teacher was when he said it to me, but I was quite young when I heard it.
You mean that Princeton class with women.
Yeah. Okay. And the teacher was the wonderful poet and editor, Theodore Weiss. But, you know, by the time you're 60, a fair bit of your life has been written in indelible ink. I will never go back and have a different family. I will never go become a Bronco rider or a welder or a painter or a dancer. And that's an interesting realization, because when you're young, all of the pathways are open. And what's interesting to me as a poet is that the malleability of my relationship to my life is infinite. That's what poems give you. Poems give you an infinite freedom of response. A different poem can look at the same event and feel very differently about it than you did 5 days ago, 5 years ago, 5 minutes ago. Writing poems change how you experience life. But the events, maybe Auden gets to win. Poetry makes nothing happen.
Well, in the words of Adrienne Rich, they make us see and seeing is changing. I've always loved that from the Planetarium poem that she is not as famous for as like Diving into the Wreck and those kinds of poems of hers. But it's also, The Path Not Taken. And you mm-hmm. get to a certain age and you realize, I mean, think about Frost and all, those paths are not going to be there anymore.
Right. Although it also, I find, is extremely useful, even when you are young and do have the choices, to realize that every step is, in fact, indelible. And that each act, each word, everything you say is consequential. And to treat your life as consequential is something that poetry has helped me do.
Well, it also gives you a kind of agency. I mean, early on,
yes.
I know there's a whole chapbook about my poems that began mm-hmm. with my. And the early poems have that ownership or that possession to them. I'll just look at my skeleton, for example, my proteins. And so it goes, my weather, my species, my eyes. Can you read one of these?
Yeah, I'll read my species, I suppose. Maybe I'll read my skeleton. But I want to say that there's a certain irony in these poems. The chapbook that you just mentioned, which was published by a relatively new San Francisco press, Missing Links, the title of that is minus MYNESS / minus the mathematical sign. And what all of these poems are kind of exploring and investigating is both the dearness with which we hold our personal lives. And Czesław Miłosz had a beautiful little poem called Minus, M-Y-N-E-S-S, that I allude to, for those who recognize it. But also, our lives are perishable, permeable, interconnected, and utterly unownable. And so a lot of these poems are a dialogue between those two ways. So my skeleton.
Before you read that, though, because I'm struck by your talking about evanescence again, and in your collection of essays, you really do talk about how, and this gets into your Buddhist background to some extent too, I suppose, but the transience. You mentioned Rilke, for example, and you mentioned that you talk about dukkhas, which I always thought of as suffering, but you've given me a new light on or a new window on. It just may be that we're perturbed or dissatisfied.
Right. That's what the Sanskrit means. Yeah.
But there it is, you know, that sense of just realizing how ephemeral everything is and how impermanent everything is. And yet you come away from a lot of your poems with joy instead of, you know, the sorrow that many people can interpret from that.
Yes. Well, I hope both. And, you know, it's not only Buddhism that notices that we're transient. I think it's fairly unavoidable in a human life. But, you know, this is a really good example of my looking at what stays, what goes, and what's our relationship to it. My skeleton. My skeleton, who once ached with your own growing larger, are now each year imperceptibly smaller, lighter, absorbed by your own concentration. When I danced, you danced. When you broke, I. And so it was, lying down, walking, climbing the tiring stairs. Your jaws, my bread. Someday you, what is left of you, will be flensed of this marriage. Angular wrist bones arthritis, cracked harp of rib cage, blunt of heel, opened bowl of the skull, twin platters of pelvis. Each of you will leave me behind, at last serene. What did I know of your days, your nights? I who held you all my life inside my hands and thought they were empty. You who held me all your life in your hands, as a new mother holds her own unblanketed child, not thinking at all.
It's lovely. That's Jane Hirschfeld reading from her new book, The Beauty. Poor Yorick, I knew him well. About all kinds of skeletons and memento moris come to mind, but also just, you know, Delmore Schwartz, a poem he wrote called The Heavy Bear That Goes With Me, about body, you know,
yes.
just how one's body changes and becomes more toward the skeleton. It's actually a very moving poem. You say zero plus anything is a world.
Mm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, that was a poem which was written in response to, and again, this is, you know, partially what happens when people reach a certain age. Many people begin dying. So most of my immediate family has died now. Great elder beloved poets have died. Friends my own age have died. And so this poem was a response to noticing the what one could call the great subtraction. Should I read it?
Please.
Zero plus anything is a world. Four less one is three. Three less two is one. One less three is what is who remains. The first cell that learned to divide learned to subtract. Recipe, add salt to hunger. Recipe, add time to trees. Zero plus anything is a world. This one and no other, unhidden by each breath changed. Recipe, add death to life. Recipe, love without swerve what this will bring. Sister, father, mother, husband, daughter. Like a cello forgiving one note as it goes, then another. So I suppose what that title line means is that no matter how much is taken from us, so long as we are alive, the world is full, complete, and sufficient, and joyous, as you said. So a poem of grief must hold joy. Poems of joy always hold grief. There's not a good love poem written that doesn't somewhere in some comma or fracture of language admit that the lovers will die.
Again, we're talking to Joan Hirschfield, and her new book is Beauty. She also has a new collection, The Beauty, excuse me. She also has a new collection of essays out, 10 Windows, How Great Poems Transform the World. And let's talk a bit about that transformation. I mean, a lot for you comes through as ordinariness. I mean, think of William Carlos Williams, No Truth Except in Things and all that, but also just a kind of vivid consciousness about being mindful of one's being in the present,
yes,
allowing the present to sort of be absorbed in every cell and being aware of just what's going on. But also there's all this title, The Beauty, struck me because there's all this hiddenness, you know, that poetry allows us to understand. I think that's a word you use, in fact, hiddenness.
Yes, there's a chapter about hiddenness in the book. And the thing about the book is, you know, it is ostensibly a book about poems and how they work. But because poems are the expression, and in some ways one of the deepest expressions you can find of human existence, if you talk about how poems work, you're talking about how human beings work. And hiddenness is an awfully large factor of any human life, whether we're talking about, you know, simple shyness and the issues of speaking versus being silent at any possible moment, but also much of our lives is hidden even from ourselves. And for me, one of the great things about poems is that they are a way of almost snagging some slight edge of what is hidden and bringing it into visibility for a moment and then letting it go, because poems are closer to chemical reactions than they are to brick walls.
Or you say closer to eros and closer to almost
yes.
Kind of procreative hunger.
Yes, yes, yes. But they are experiences. They aren't artifacts that you can climb on like a jungle gym. They're experiences that you have to have by reading or hearing or writing the poem. There's no other access to them except through their own gate. And so I love hiddenness, for one thing, because I love tactfulness. I love riddles. I love the way alluding to what can't be said, even if it can never be said, we hear it.
There is something in it that is authentic. I'm thinking, of course, of Marianne Moore's great poem, Poetry, you know, Imaginary Gardens with Real Toads in Them. There's something of the authentic that poetry allows us to feel, experience, that invades our consciousness, that can bring about change or transformation, which is precisely your point.
Yes.
But are we also, I also think about, you know, the unacknowledged legislators as the poets. I mean, that gets us into the political realm. That was what
right.
Shelley believed poets were.
Right? Right. Well, I think for those of us in America today, we feel pretty unacknowledged. You know, it is not, we're not making a great deal of congressional lawmaking turn in a direction that many of us might prefer. And I don't want to imply that poets are a unified field of political opinion. We're not. But poets probably have a bias towards recognizing interconnection, towards recognizing that the natural world matters to us, towards recognizing even that justice and equality matter. And I think this is built into the fabric of how poems are made. If you use a metaphor about a fence, you are in some way having an empathic relationship to fenceness. everything becomes alive. Cavafy said that once. He said, you know, in me now, everything is alive. Furniture, streets, everything is feeling.
They also make for better neighbors, right?
Oh, well.
Unless we forget.
I have poets as my neighbors, actually. It's a very literary neighborhood.
More frost again.
But we don't feel, you know, it's a funny business because the way I work with this incredible riddle of poetry and the effect. How do great poems transform the world? And I think they transform the world through the quiet transformation of individual human beings. And that any human being who for a moment feels their vulnerability, their common shared fate with others, allows their sense of grief to surface, to the degree that that stays with them, they will act in the direction of things that I also care about.
And you're also talking on a larger scale of transformation by art, really.
Yes.
I mean, poetry certainly and art in itself, mm-hmm. but art itself. And what you're also talking about on the individual level, it seems to me, especially in your essays, is vision, is again seeing.
Yes. So that's, I think, the first sentence of the preface is good art is a truing of vision the way a saw is trued in a saw shop. But I think it also, the great thing is that multiplicity, complexity, subtlety, allowance of non-single-minded, arrogant certainty is a gift that all art carries. It's part of what makes it art. And so again, you know, there's a chapter in Ten Windows about uncertainty. And uncertainty makes us anxious. You know, as mammals, we really want to know where our next meal is coming from and where we're going to sleep in safety. And yet it is the nature of life to be always uncertain. We will always be surprised. We will always have things happen to us which we wish didn't. We still have to continue. And art is one of the ways that the unbearable can be born.
You even have a poem about the journey of a common cold, which, you know.
Yes, I tried to have. I was really sick when I wrote that poem. And it was one of those colds that lasted for 5 weeks and you coughed and coughed and coughed. But, you know, I tried to have some empathy with this virus, and I realized it was immortal. It was traveling around the world, you know, from person to person, having its own very adventurous life.
In the book of essays, the new book of essays, again, Ten Windows, How Great Poems Transform the World, you start out with Gerard Manley Hopkins, who, one of the great poets, clearly, but also a man known for his sprung rhythm. And how mm-hmm. important is prosody? How important are the rhythms of poetry and the music of poetry and the cadences of poetry as opposed to just the language itself and the content of the language?
Yes, well, absolutely, inextricably part of the content. And for me, even though I tend to write quite frequently in a plainer sounding voice, not always, but you know, many of my poems sound plain in the way of William Carlos Williams, if there were no music, if the language was not hearing itself as it conducted itself across syllable, 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 I could not be thinking or feeling in the way of poems. Music is the foundation for thinking in a different way, because poetry thinks with the whole body, the whole life, all the senses. And if it had no musicality, it would be dead in the water.
But language is really the underlying key. And you say language wakes me up in the morning. I mean, it does, right?
Well, the essay, the chapter is called Language Wakes Up in the Morning,
language
not
wakes
me.
Up in the
it's
morning.
Doing it on its own.
It's almost autonomous and
yeah, it's
divisible.
As we call it, technically personification of language. I take in that chapter, I imagine that, you know, language is getting out of bed and it has absolutely nothing and it's sitting there and it wants to end up doing its job. What does it need to do that? And I sort of walk through that it begins with what I sort of refer to as the left leg and the right leg, image and statement. And then I start adding things to that. And music is one of the things which is added, and imagination and metaphor and, you know, all of a whole slew of devices, including what you mentioned earlier. The last thing I think language needs, if it's going to be writing a poem rather than, you know, a piece of journalism or a tech report or whatever, it needs some dissatisfaction. It needs the burr of discomfort. I don't write poems because I'm pleased with myself. I don't write poems because I know something. I write poems because something in me requires that fabric of invention and embodiment in order to discover a balance. I'm sort of
like
falling,
an equilibrium type of balance?
Well, a momentary balance, because then, of course, we're unbalanced again by right. our lives. But that, you know, we write poems because something has disturbed us, and human life is by nature disturbed, so poems are fairly welcome.
Do you see images when you write poems?
They come to me, but my poems come to me in the words. So the words are seeing the image. I mean, this is getting a little, I don't want to make distinctions that hardly matter. I suppose dreams are almost entirely visual and generally fairly wordless, but we know what the words would be. We can tell a dream in words. Poems come to me in an almost innerly heard language. That's why I say music comes mm-hmm. first. But what comes on that language is very often images. So again, they're kind of two sides of one coin that can't be cut.
Yeah, poem can be very much like a dream, in fact. Or
well,
certainly
I think they
have the
are.
Landscape and the feel of a dream. Yeah,
yeah, I think it's a kind of, it's what the mind does in a state halfway between regular chattering, rational thought, and dream, that poems are from the middle realm between those two ways that our minds can work.
Talking about poetry with a distinguished poet and local resident here in the Bay Area, Jane Hirschfield, who has two books out. One is called The Beauty. It's her eighth volume of poems, and also her second collection of essays, 10 Windows, How Great Poems Transform the World. I'd like to open up the phone lines and give listeners an opportunity not only to join this conversation, tell me why you love poetry or why it's obscure and hateful to you or whatever, but also if you have a particular poem that has moved you or has maybe even transformed you. I'd like to hear what that, and I'm sure Jane would as well, what that poem is, what comes to mind in this fleeting existence of ours in terms of a poem that particularly had impact or effect on you, and you are welcome to join us now. Our toll-free number is available. And we'll hear perhaps Jane read a few more of her poems from this new collection. But we invite you to participate. Toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone calls, so you can call us now. 866-733-6786 is the number to call, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or go to our website and post any questions or comments or whatever's on your mind or heart there, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Talking again with Jane Hirschfield, who is a poet, translator, and essayist, and I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, speaking this hour with Jane Hirschfield, poet, translator, and essayist. Her two new books are called The Beauty and a collection of essays titled 10 Windows, How Great Poems Transform the World. We're asking listeners how certain poems that may come to mind may have indeed led to some transformation in you. And we're talking about the value of poetry. And really, as I said to Jane off mic just a moment ago, I've had the great privilege of interviewing some really great poets through the years. And the truth of the matter is that they all have a kind of true faith in the power of poetry and the power of poetry to not only expand our senses and expand our consciousness, but really affect us and transform us. So if you would like to join the conversation, you're welcome to do so. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And we've got a caller from Fairfax. Kara, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. The poem that came to mind when you asked the question was St. Francis and the Sow by Galway Kennell.
I love that poem.
That imagery. And there's two distinct parts to it. There's sort of this ethereal beginning and then this really mucky real ending. And as a woman in this culture, it shifted, like, sort of how I felt about my body, or at least it was an invitation to that shift. And I love that it was written by a man. So I just wanted to say that.
Yeah, thank you. So how did it transform you, though? I asked that. We were talking about poetry transforming. It opened your senses, your mind, but what other effect?
I put it on an image of one of my paintings. I'm a watercolorist, and I gave it to an organization called Beyond Hunger, because it was like, you know, there's this idea that we have to be perfect to be blessed, and you know, this big sow with her spiny spikes and laying in the muck with all these piglets, you know, suckling on her, was Saint Francis blessed her. I mean, that was the whole idea. And it just was like, so lying in the ditch, you know, figuratively, you know, in our lives, sweaty and ugly, I'm blessed. You know, it's just like, it's just an invitation to a whole nother way of understanding perfection and humanness and being in a woman's body. And I don't know, transformed. It's just a perspective that was transformed. So I can hold myself differently.
Yeah, that's really beautifully put. And I myself experienced that poem as a great act of rescue and confirmation. That, you know, it is basically, you know, Galway Canal is seeing the sow, which one can guess is probably a stand-in for a state of the human condition and perhaps a particular person, and recognizes that if somebody can look at, as you so, you know, well described it, you know, a pig in the muck, floored by bodily functions, and recognize that as beautiful, we all feel rescued in necessary ways.
There's another wonderful poem of Canals that comes to mind, where a skunk, and you know the poem I'm talking about? It's said here when he was actually living here, and a skunk comes by, and suddenly he's thinking about his marriage in a very tender way and missing his wife. And I'm going blank on the title of the poem, but...
Yeah, I'm not sure Galway ever lived here. He taught up in Squaw Valley a number of times, but I don't think he ever lived in the Bay Area.
Well, he was in Bolinas, I think, when he wrote this.
Okay.
I think so, maybe just spending there overnight or something along those lines. But we'll bring some more of our callers in, and let's go to Oakland and welcome Kristen. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Kristen. You're on.
So I have two poems that I really like. One of the poems is from Wordsworth, Tintern Abbey.
Mm. Great poem. Yeah.
Yeah. And Tintern Abbey is one of my favorites because it's nostalgic. It just reminds you of what it's like when you've lived in a place for a long time and then all of a sudden you leave. And then come back to see what it's like. And so I've always liked Tintern Abbey because of that.
And did it transform you or have that kind of effect, would you say?
It didn't necessarily transform me, but every time I go back home to Texas, I think about that poem. So I always have, like, a relation towards that.
And you had another one, too, you wanted to mention, Kristen. What was that?
Yeah, now this one definitely is something that probably transformed me. It's a biblical poem, The Song of Solomon, because it's just about a very rich king who tried to woo a young maiden, but she was not interested in him, even though he was very rich. She was interested in a shepherd boy. So it's just funny how it can be when you fall in love. It is a situation where money doesn't matter. And so I'm happily married to someone who's not very wealthy, but it's who I love. So I have a connection to that one, too.
Well, thank you for your call. I appreciate your calling in. And, of course, one help thinking about Shepherds and Love, Come Live With Me and Be My Love, and We Shall All the Pleasures Prove, which is still a lovely poem in so many ways. Here's Bill, who writes, I'm about four chapters into 10 windows and already feel like a curtain has been drawn aside. I am sort of amazed at the power of Miss Hirschfeld's writing. The book is anything but dry. I wonder if she's had any surprising reactions from other readers or reviewers.
Well, the most surprising reaction was a 94-year-old woman who let me know that she had never been able to read poems very well, never been able to understand them particularly. It wasn't something she'd spent her life doing. But she found that when she went from trying to read the poems in the beauty to reading, delving into 10 windows, reading a little bit, going back to my own work in the beauty, she suddenly found the poems opening and more understandable to her. You may have guessed by now who the 94-year-old woman is. It's my mother. So I'm imagining, you know, this is the best blurb you'll never see on the back of a book. You know, at 94, poetry has begun to be accessible to me. And then under it, Jane's mom.
Well, for the paperback, maybe. Kevin writes on our Facebook page, I just wanted Jane to know someone got the reference from the first poem she read, There Is No Other Life, quote, Why Log Truck Drivers Rise Earlier Than Students of Zen by Gary Snyder.
Wonderful poem. And Gary has a new book out, The Present Moment, which is absolutely a pinnacle book. I recommend it to everyone.
I just received it, and I'm anxious to look at it. A pinnacle book for him is saying a lot.
Yes, it is.
And by the way, Jane will be at Bookshop West Portal tomorrow at 7 p.m. And on April 13th, she'll be at a Great Good Place for Books in Oakland. And on April 30th, she'll be at Diesel Books at Larkspur Landing. Have you, if I may, before we go to more calls, read another poem? I thought maybe the opening poem, which deserves a little bit of explication along Portuguese lines.
Yes. So the first poem in the book is a kind of, it's a frontispiece poem in that it's before the formal first section. The title is Fado, and a fado is a kind of Portuguese song of love and longing and the trials of an ordinary human life. We first hear about fados the beginning of the 19th century. It was music of the sailors and dock workers of Lisbon. And so it has influence from all over the world because the sailors would bring back African rhythms and Brazilian and Caribbean. What was interesting to me to discover long after I had written this poem and long after I had put it at the front of this book was that the word fado is also simply the Portuguese word for fate. And this book is full of references to fate. So, fado. A man reaches close and lifts a quarter from inside a girl's ear. From her hands takes a dove she didn't know was there. Which amazes more, you may wonder, the quarter's serrated murmur against the thumb or the dove's knuckled silence? That he found them, or that she never had? Or that in Portugal, this same half-stopped moment, it's almost dawn, and a woman in a wheelchair is singing a fado that puts every life in the room on one pan of a scale, itself on the other, and the copper bowl's balance.
Yeah, very nice and nicely read. Why did you position this poem where it is?
It was that balancing of grief and beauty in the copper bowls, I think, which caused me to put it first. But also, you know, the very opening of it that, you know, a quarter comes from inside of our ear, a dove comes from inside of us. This is what poems feel like as well. This is what art does. I also have to say, I don't know, you asked me, do images come to me? And I don't know why the woman who appeared in this poem is in a wheelchair, but I know I was very glad that she was. And it wasn't because it's some simplistic trope for the wounded psyche. It was because some people are in wheelchairs. Mm. And that has nothing to do with whether or not they're capable of having a full life or making beauty. Just some people are in wheelchairs, and I'd never had a person in a wheelchair in a poem before, and I was glad for one to arrive.
It's often a surprise along those lines. There's a famous essay by Flannery O'Connor where she writes about her somewhat famous story, Good Country People, and says she didn't know that this young man who this woman with a I'm trying to think of the politically correct way to describe it. She has what is described by O'Connor as a stump for a leg, a wooden stump for a leg. And he decides to try to induce her, while she thinks she's seducing him, to give her, to mm-hmm. let him hold the leg. And then he runs off with it as a souvenir. She said she didn't know that was going to happen until yes. they got up in this attic area, wherever they were. And it happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a sense, even when you're composing a poem, a wheelchair will come, or you know, something will happen that completely surprises you. Yes,
absolutely. And in fact, I never know what's going to happen when I start a poem. I never know. It knows more than I do, because sometimes I'll write a line and I will simply go, oh no, that's not it. I'll cross it out and then I'll wait for something else to come, even though I don't know where the poem is going to end in the first draft process.
How many drafts? Usually.
Oh, it varies a lot. I've done poems with as many as, you know, 80 or 90, and I've done poems that stay very close to the first words that were set down.
Rare, though, to have a poem that's not edited or that doesn't go through at least a couple of drafts?
Well, I at least ask the poem if it wants to change. And there's a very short poem in this book, which I'm sure is exactly the words that came exactly as they came unchanged. Two linen handkerchiefs. How can you have been dead 12 years and these still?
Yeah, and then it stops.
Yeah.
I found that very moving.
And when that came, there was no editing to be done to it.
Yeah. Well, here's Carolyn, who writes, I was changed by Jane's poem, The Supple Deer, which opened up the realm of eco-feminist poetry for me. I was wondering if Jane could speak to the potential for such poetry to help address our imposing environmental problems.
Well, that is a marvelous question, and I have to apologize that because I don't have my poems memorized, it's in an earlier book, and I can't recite it so that other people would know
what you're
talking about. Maybe. Oh, yes, it's very available online. But, you know, it is a poem of permeability and a poem of welcoming permeability. And I think that's very much part of ecofeminism. It's very much part of I'm going to get quickly, I hope, professorial. In the history of Western literature, the earliest epic we have is Gilgamesh. And Gilgamesh,
which is basically the Noah story.
Yeah. But Gilgamesh goes out, and I'm going to cut it really short here. The first thing he and Enkidu, his friend, do when they team up is they go into the primeval forest and they cut down the tallest tree. And at the end of that poem, the last thing Gilgamesh does, having discovered that nothing he can do is going to give him immortality, is he builds a big wall. Now, I think we can draw some very interesting ecological conclusions from this being the poem of the Western tradition. It's when the world was vast and terrifying, becoming human meant separating from that vast. It meant establishing human agency, establishing human civilization, but it's almost an original sin. And now, 4,000 years later, here we are, probably longer than 4,000 years, here we are in rather the opposite situation, in that we ourselves will not survive if we cannot find a way for the trees and the forest to survive and to acknowledge that putting a wall between us and the rest of existence is not going to be a good idea.
Jane Herfield is our guest this hour, and looking at some more emails from you, our listeners, Rick writes, Dulce et Decorum Est was my favorite in the anti-war vein, along with the death of the, he says, turret ball gunner. It's a ball turret gunner. It's
both great
Randall,
poems.
They are both great poems, especially the concision of Randall Jarrell's poem, The Death of the Ball Turret Gunner, has always kind of taken my breath for speech, as Yeats would say.
Yes.
It's an extraordinary poem. Amanda writes, Jane, have you ever found words inadequate for what you want to convey?
Just about every moment, including this one.
Barbara writes, The Journey by Mary Oliver changed the course of my life in a very powerful way. I had struggled for years to figure out how I could save my life from a very bad, unsupportive marriage and two disabled children, one mentally unstable and one developmentally delayed. Even though they were adults, I felt myself increasingly invisible. I sent it to all of my friends and family, announcing it was time to live my life. I can never thank Mary Oliver enough for giving me the courage to begin my own journey. And Charlotte writes, one poem I loved while I was younger was Still I Rise by Maya Angelou. Still to this day, the poem makes me cry. The defiance and power evoked by the imagery of the ocean is overwhelming. Even though the poem has a different historical context than how I relate to it, it is a beautiful poem for anyone who is struggling at the moment. You know, this is a little delicate topic, but there are those who would say, Mary Oliver, Maya Angelou, they would maybe take away from their power as poets because they've had popular success. I mean, you recognize that phenomenon, I think, don't you?
You know, I have seen it and I recognize
Rod McEwen, for an extreme example.
No. Yes, who was extremely bitter about not having been accepted by the larger poetry world, I have heard. You know, all of this will pass. What matters is the words, not the sociology. Good poems that save people's lives, change people's lives, have lasting value, will not be forgotten.
Here's David, who writes a poem I find moving and somewhat transformative, What the Living Do by Marie Howe.
Yes.
Gave me solace after losing loved ones. I thought it was a good study on grief and mindfulness. I read it again and again. It's amazing. I mean, and you point out in your new essay collection just how much we can be helped by poetry in times of grieving and times of sorrow and despair. Here's another Mary Oliver poem from Terry. It says, my favorite poem is Wild Geese by Mary Oliver. The poem is for me about forgiveness. It opened a place for me to forgive myself and others. Chris writes, read any D.A. Powell? He's a local San Franciscan. He was my poetry teacher at USF, and I regard him as the smartest, funniest man I've ever met.
He's fantastic.
Rick writes, I wonder if our guest knows the poems of Eugenio Montal. They are written in Italian. Poems about the simple beauties of nature and our human condition. One of my favorites is Lemoni, the lemons or lemon trees, about how the sight of lemon trees in an urban yard evokes memories and our sensual experience of nature, a poem that moves the spirit.
I'm very happy to hear him praised. He's been multiply translated, I think, in the last 10 years. And, you know, the whole tradition of 20th century European poems have a great deal to teach us about the appreciation of the ordinary. We think of these things, we think of it as having come into us through haiku and Japanese and Chinese traditions, but with a different tone, a different flavor, a different subtlety, a different historical awareness. Equally, you know, the poets of Italy, especially of Poland, of early 20th century Greece, of Scandinavia, let us bow towards the recently gone to us Thomas Tranströmer. I'm a great believer in reading the poetry of the world, not just one's own backyard, although one's own backyard in the Bay Area is filled with genius.
Well, we did have in our backyard a genius of a poet who has European ancestry and European origins, and that's Milos. And you talk about My Faithful Mother Tongue in your book, which I never really thought of the poem actually being about the language of poetry. I always thought, you know, he's talking about his mother tongue of Polish.
Right. Right, but it's equally about the mother tongue of being able to write poems. And you used the word, you know, I believe, saving. You know, poems save us. And the act of continuing to be a person who can find the vulnerability of being that is required to read a poem or to write a poem, that in itself is a saving from defended rationality. And, you know, we've had look at the people who have been cited in just these few emails, in Maya Angelou. And I think what happens for each reader is you find the poets who address your own condition of life and give you a kind of hand in the dark.
Well, look what she did at the inaugural poem of Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
I mean, it was something that really reached all the hope and all of the positive feeling that people had.
And also she spoke of geology, which I just adored, that, you know, that poem went all the way into the literal bedrock of our shared experience.
See how you just moved that metaphor? Moved into the bedrock of our experience with geology. Love it. Let me get another caller on, and that's Irma. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you doing? First of all, I want to just thank you for bringing poetry on the air. I love your guests and yourself. I just wanted to share that I met my first husband through poetry. I was at a health convention for Alternative Medicine for Cancer Control Society as a vendor, you know. I was with my herbal medicine there, and we were kind of inside the lecture hall, so we were forced to listen to all the speakers, and he was a keynote speaker speaking about, you know, the environment, how the environment affects our health. And then all of a sudden, it's like he started reciting a poem. It's like, what? You know, it's like he came out of left field, and it was an amazing poem. It's called Death Dance of the Dinosaurs. It was inspired by the first, you know, Bush's Gulf War, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was just, it just touched me so much. It's like, damn, who is this person? You know? And touched everybody. Everybody gave him a standing ovation for that poem, you know? And I said, you know, I have to meet this man, you know? So we met, and he ended up, he had a electric car there, a Porsche Spitzer 1957 convertible, you know, it's a demo car. And, anyway, he ended up giving me a ride home, and, 18 days later we were married. it was a poem that, connected me. It's a beautiful poem. I don't know if you guys have heard of it, but, he published it in a book of poetry called The Spirit Flies Free, The Kundalini Poems by Neil Bethel Sinclair. And it's all these poems, by the way, have been, I would say, kind of the way he says it, he started writing poetry after he had some Kundalini experience when he was 18 years old in UC Berkeley.
Well, it certainly changed your life, Irma. I mean, we have to see with the marriage. And thank you for the call. I'm looking at another listener who says, for all my life, from adolescence to my seventh decade, one poem has always moved me. Li Po's Taking Leave of a Friend, an English translation, of course. From English adaptations by Amy Lowell, Ezra Pound, to Arthur Cooper, to Virtual Unknowns, they all move me. The two short quatrains have rich layers of meaning and feeling and a timeless nature that reveals itself afresh at every reading. That's from George. But as a translator, you must realize a lot gets lost in translation.
A lot gets lost. It's a continual act of having to choose which betrayal serves the experience. I have co-translated from the two Japanese women, the two great women poets of the Japanese classical tradition. And then in Ten Windows, there's a long chapter about Basho, who my co-translator graciously came back and helped me translate those haiku as well. But I think this, again, is something to speak to the power of poetry, that we refer to a poem written in Sumerian. We refer to poems written in Japanese and Chinese and Swahili. And enough comes through that these poems can continue to mean something to us.
As you say in your book, every culture on the globe has
yes.
poetry. Here's a little bit of a heretical remark from a listener. I think I know this listener, too. He writes, I'm sure this will sound hopelessly old-fashioned, but I can't read any contemporary poetry now. To me, it's just prose broken into jagged lines. The ideas and imagery are impossible to parse. And whatever happened to light verse? Updike was the last to write it.
Well, that listener might like some of, because there's so much sound work in it and also so much wit, try K. Ryan. You might find yourself congenially surprised.
Or Billy Collins.
Yes.
Under the same kind of rubric. Let me bring another caller on. Do we have time? Yeah, I think we do. For you, Zoe, good morning. Is it Zoe or Zoe?
It's Zoe. Good morning.
Hi, Zoe.
Hi. So I had a question, and also a question related to a story. So as a teenager, a very nerdy teenager, I loved Sonnet to Sleep by John Keats. And it starts, "Oh, soft embalmer of still midnight, and shaded in forgetfulness divine. And shutting in careful fingers and begun, our gloom please eyes embrowed from the light, and shaded in forgetfulness divine." And I never knew what forgetfulness divine meant. And until I took this blues class, and I was trying to sing this Ry Cooder tune, and it just didn't really work out. And I completely left out a verse, But we were lucky enough to have a sort of band with us. So I just asked them to play it again. And I remembered. And I realized that, like, that sort of empowerment to just continue and ask for what I needed in the moment, even though I'd forgotten it, was, for me, forgetfulness divine. And I was wondering, Jane, if you had a similar personal experience like that, where a poem has taught you something personal to you. I know you were saying about the appreciation of the ordinary in European poetry, but did you have a personal experience with a poem that way?
Sorry, seconds left. Let me get a response from Jane Hirschfeld.
Yes, so there was a life-changing poem for me by the Japanese poet Izumi Shikibu. It is true the wind blows terribly here, but moonlight also leaks between the roof planks of this ruined house. And what that poem taught me was, if you do not welcome the cold rain, the difficult weather, the hard winds into a life, you will equally wall yourself off from beauty and all that you might desire.
What a wonderful place to end this hour, which I enjoyed very much. Thank you, Jane. Jane Hirschfeld, poet, translator, essayist, new book of poetry, The Beauty, collection of essays, 10 Windows, How Great Forms Transform the World. And she'll be at Bookshop West Portal tomorrow, 7 p.m., and on April 13th at A Great Good Place for Books in Oakland, and on April 30th, she'll be at Diesel Books at Larkspur Landing. We thank you for being part of this morning's program. Our producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Jim Bennett, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And for all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.